Ways to improve spiritually. Infinite number of ways to improve spiritually, aren't there? What is the way that we would improve spiritually ourselves? What would be the best way we could improve spiritually? Is to turn our attention toward that which we really believe about ourselves. Now, we can improve humanly, physically, we can improve mentally, and we can improve spiritually. There's three areas that we can improve, three areas that we can grow and develop. Now, how do we improve spiritually? You'd think that if you were spiritually alive or spiritually aware of yourself, you'd be, you know, totally done. You'd be cooked. You'd be complete. But then what would be the ways to improve? Why would you improve if you were already finished? Well, our concept here of ways to improve spiritually is ways to become more aware of our spiritual reality. It's just like if we were to say, here is a cup of water, and this cup of water stands here and is ready to be used and utilized. And if you don't drink it, if you don't wash with it, if you don't cook with it, if you don't use it in some way, the water is still there, but you're not using it. Our spirituality is still there, but we're not using it. Let's consider for a few minutes what our spirituality is. What does it mean to be spiritual? To be spiritual means that you are completely free of any thought of human or relative attitudes. Spiritual includes the human, includes the relative, includes all these things, but of itself it is free from that. To be spiritual, you are unlimited. You are not limited by any human attitude you might have. You're not limited by any human experience you might have, a physical body you might have, or a mental attitude you might have. Even mental, yeah. Because spiritual is all-inclusive. It's like saying the allness, the isness. It's like saying that which we are. But why is it that we label things with all these separate words? Spiritual, mental, physical, relative, absolute. Why do we label things like that? We label them so that we can get a hold of them, so we can think about them and act on them. If we didn't label them, we wouldn't be able to do anything about them. If I say, now, be a better person, you'd say a spiritual person, a mental person, a physical person, or all, or none, or what are you talking about? Well, be a better person. If you're a better person, you will be more considerate of your fellow man. Oh, you're talking about human. Yes, that's human. Now, if I say, be a better person of your spiritual self, what would that mean? Well, that would mean to be a better person of who you actually are, liking yourself, with no thought about anybody else. In the human domain, we must think about everybody else. We must think about each other. In the mental domain, we must think about what is a operative thought that's going on in our mind, what operative idea, what is the conditioning activity that goes on. Because in a human world, you can be oblivious to things. You can be oblivious to problems and worries and unhappiness and someone else's needs. You can be oblivious to it. But in a mental world, you cannot. In a mental world, you're aware of everything. You're tuned in to everything. You know everything that's going on. In a mental world, you are totally aware of all that's going on. You think that the physical world is where you'd be aware of that. But no, it's the mental world. Because the physical world has no attachment unless it's through the mental activity. Because if you touch a hot stove, you don't know that you've touched a hot stove until it sends a impulse up through your nerves, up through your system, to your brain. And then your brain interprets it as hot. This is why you can walk on fire. Because the thought comes up, the impulse comes up, and it's registered as heat or cold or whatever you want. When you walk on fire, you say you're walking on cool, wet moss, so the impulse comes up from what you're walking on as cool, wet moss. And you say, you can really change the outer experience of the world just that easy? That's right. But it takes a little conditioning to do it, because you have to realize that you are saying something that must take effect. This is cool, wet moss. If you, for 1 minute, say it is the red-hot coals, then you burn yourself. If you say to yourself, I'm hungry, you'll be hungry. If you say to yourself, I'm not hungry, you'll not be hungry. There are people who can go through life and eat a minimum amount of food, if any, because they do not feel hungry. Their body does not demand any food. They eat, if you will, the manna of the universe, the essence of life, and they have no need for the food. Of course, this is an advanced point of view. When you're on a human point of view and you're on a limited point of view, you think you must have food, you must have warmth, you must have water, you must have all these things to make you happy, to make your body content. But when you're working on a higher mental level, then you say to yourself, I am content. I mean, the person who has a master's body, the person who does not need food, is the same person that you are, with a different thought in their mind. That's all. Just a simple, different thought in their mind. Now, are you willing to think these thoughts and to work on them? Your body has conditioned you, or you have conditioned your body, to think that it needs food. And it needs it, and needs it, and needs it. And so, your body talks to you. You know how it is when you have a dog. You have a dog, and you train the dog to sit when you say sit. And you train the dog to come when you say come. And then when the dog sees another dog go by, it jumps up and races over to the other dog. You say, that's instinctual. No, that's poor training. You have let that dog do what it wants to do and not what you want to do. Well, it's nice for the dog to go. Okay, then tell the dog, go play with your friend. Sit, stay, and do not move until I tell you to move. And when I say move, then you can move. Then now you go play with your friend. But go. Hey, a little child is playing next to its mother, and it sees a friend, and it jumps up and runs to its friend. The mother says, stop! The child stops. The mother says, sit down. The child sits down. The mother walks over to the child and says, give me your hand. Now let's go see your friend. You don't walk across the street unless you hold my hand. You don't walk across the street. The mother wants to take care of that child. The mother wants to take responsibility for that child. The mother wants to say to that child, stop, sit. Not with any anger, not with any badness, but just because the mother wants to train that child to follow its rules. When the child is older and can know that the street is a tough place and that you want to look both ways because the cars are playing out there, the adults are playing on the street, then, when the child learns that, then the child can walk across the street after it has checked to make sure it's okay. But the parent must be very tough. Or else, and this you find very heinous, I know, keep the child on a leash. Some parents do. You know why parents keep a child on a leash? Because they haven't got the guts to teach the child to stop, to sit, to stay when they say stop. Now, I say, button, sit. I don't say, button, sit. If I say, button, sit, that means I'm not sure of myself. If I say, button, sit, with love, with confidence, no anger, no forced emotion, then button sits. I had Gus, and we were up in Minneapolis, and we were walking along this country road by Andromeda. And as we were walking along the road, a car started coming from a distance, and I said, Gus, sit. I didn't know how to say, stay by my side, because he hadn't gotten that point. But he did know sit. So I said, sit. So we sat there, and the car drove by, and then I said, release, and then he went off and played again. Now, as soon as I taught him to heal, to walk with me, then that was okay. He didn't have to sit every time a car came along or something. Now, let's just pretend that you're parents. Do you love your child? Do you want your child to remain alive? Do you want your child to be with you at your side? Do you want your child to enjoy you? And let's just shift gears for a minute. This man was over here, and the dog jumped out of the car. And the dog looked up at his master and sat there and said, are we ready to play? And the master just went on talking to somebody else. Are we ready to play? And the master just went on talking to somebody else. And then the dog walked a little ways away and wasn't called back, so he realized he could go further. And so he ran way up here and playing with everybody and coming on back. But he always came back to said, hey, are we ready to play? I want to be with you. It's okay for me to go talk to these other dogs and do, but I'd rather be with you. I'd rather be with you. You're much more fun. You make me feel very content and happy, and you make me feel very good. I want to be with you. Now, is that wrong? Is that an evil thing for the master to teach the dog that it's most happy when it's with him? No. This is beautiful. This is what we should do with our children, is to train them to be most happy when they're with us and that we enjoy their company. And now, after all this discussion, let's go to the body. Our body eats everything we dump down it. And it eats more than we need to dump down it. And we fill it very comfortably. And so when we don't dump so much down our body says, hey, don't you like me anymore? You're not giving me enough. You know, how about I can eat some more ice cream. I can have another dish of ice cream. There's room for some more ice cream. Come on, you know. And then we pour more ice cream down. And we pour more goodies down. But we let our body tell us, because we have told our body it can have anything it wants. You know how some people do with their children. Oh, eat what you want. Do what you want. You want another hamburger? You want another hot dog? Go ahead. Have 6, 8, 10. Get yourself sick, you know. Then you won't want so much later on. Wouldn't it be nice to train them without getting sick? Wouldn't it be nice to learn how to smoke cigars without getting sick on the first cigar? If a parent would just say to the child, I think it's interesting how people smoke cigars. They must really not like their bodies because they put all that tobacco in there. And when people do that, they must really not like it. I personally don't like to smoke cigars or cigarettes or pipe or anything because it's not good for my body. The kid hears this, he learns this, and then he responds to that. He doesn't say he wants to smoke. He doesn't even think about smoking because he has never even thought smoking to be a good thing. His friends say, come on, have a smoke. He says, no, I'm not interested. But back to our body again. Our body is trained by us to think it can have anything it wants. And so, the bakery is good. The cake is good. The dinner is good. Oh, such a good cook. Well, stupid. Stupid. We tantalize our body to have things that it doesn't even need. Now, we don't eat a great deal here, but we still eat far more than we need. We eat more abundantly. We use sauces and we use things that make the food even more delicious to make us tantalized to eating it. And so then we're going to eat more than we need. It's not a matter that's good or bad, it's just that we eat more than we need. And so then our body gets accustomed to having it, and then it wants it. And it wants these things, and it wants us to do all these things, and that's okay. But our difficulty is that just because the kid wants more food, even though it's not good for it, we give it to it. Just because our body wants more food, we give it to it. Now, why do we do that? That's your friend going up there again. Why do we do that? Because we think our body needs it. Our body doesn't need it. It's just we've been accustomed to giving it to it. And you see, all of these things train us. They train us away from being spiritual. They train us away from being master of ourselves. they train us away. We could very well train our bodies to eat much less. You know, a good way to train your body to eat less? Not be able to afford it. Live in a limited circumstance where every bite of food you take has to do a job. And so you only eat foods that are rich and good for you. You don't waste your money on beer and wine, and you don't waste your money on sweets. You don't waste your money on things that are going to flash through the body and not build and grow. And so you buy things that you feel are nourishing and good for the body, and you eat it. And that's beautiful. So when we train ourselves, not to need these things, pretty soon our body becomes less and less demanding. It's still a good body. In fact, it's even a better body. As I told you the other day, the scientists have found with fruit flies, they can double their life by feeding them less, by giving them not a total minimum diet, but almost a minimum diet. They have doubled their life. And they're looking into the possibility of that with man, although that's difficult because man likes to eat. Now, when we can train ourselves not to be possessed by food, not to be possessed by breathing.
Breathing, it's free. It's just air
in and out. Well, not to be possessed by it. Think of what you do about breathing once. What do you do about breathing? You breathe in and you breathe out and you think, you don't think anything about it. And then you get up in thinner oxygen and a higher altitude and you begin to realize you have to breathe in more deeply. And you have to let it go through your body and you have to reacclimate yourself to the higher altitude. But now think of that. At a higher altitude, the air is rarefied and you don't get as much air, oxygen. And so, at first, you get all sorts of headaches and other things from the lack of oxygen, because you're accustomed to more oxygen. But then, the more you live up there, the more you're in that environment, the less you need. Because it's not there to be had, so your body adjusts to it. And you know what a Sherpa is? That's the people who carry the Himalayan trip people up the mountain, and they live in that area. And they can carry these great big packs on their back and think nothing of it. Just like people who go to the moon. They can jump on the moon with a big pack on their back because the gravity is different. And here, the Sherpa, living up there in that high altitude, has built his body conditioned in keeping with it. Many of the people who come from the lowlands to go up to the highlands, they take along an oxygen bottle, because without that they feel very weak, very tired, and headache, and many other problems. But the longer they stay there, the less they need of that rich oxygen they had below, and they can get along without it. Now, I don't know whether an experiment's been conducted on it, but when they come back down the mountain, after having been acclimated to the thinner air, can they operate at a higher level because they get more oxygen, more air? Be interesting to see. It's just like athletes who are going to be running a triathlon or do anything like that in Denver, Colorado, the Mile High City, by 1,680 feet up in the air. If they're going to be up there, then they have to get used to that altitude, right? And so they go up there to live for 6 months before the races, and their bodies are living in condition with the atmosphere. Now, has a test ever been done? If they would come down from there and into the richer atmosphere, would they be able to even run better because their bodies were acclimated to using less oxygen? Be a fascinating thing.
So, they do.
Well, then there's your answer. They do.
Because the body produces more red blood cells in higher altitude, so the muscle can intake more, and that's the production of the speed is increased by that.
But see how interesting it is? Just in a different environment, you have the different abilities, different capacity within yourself. So when we train ourselves not to need these things, so we don't train ourselves not to need these things, we train ourselves to enjoy, this all sounds less, not, and stuff like that, we train ourselves to enjoy a less amount of food. We train ourselves to get the most out of the food that we eat so that we don't need to have so much food. We train ourselves to get the most out of the oxygen we breathe so that we can use less oxygen if such is the case, and eventually no oxygen. Wouldn't that be interesting? Mm. And eventually no food. This is being done by some people. And we think, my goodness, that's something that we couldn't possibly do, but could we? So, when we are living on our spiritual aspect, and this is why so many times we read about the Hindus who are working on this very diligently from the physical point of view. They're training themselves to use less food, training themselves to use less water, training themselves to breathe less, training themselves to do all sorts of things, and they go into sort of inert states. They go into states of meditation where their breathing is cut down to so tiny you don't even know they're alive. But are these things that they are doing making them better spiritually? And I say, no, that's not. To make your 100% attention on breathing less or eating less or drinking less or whatever does not make you more spiritual. What makes you more harmonious with your spiritual self is when you don't need it. You see, it's the need that is the difference. These people still need to breathe. They still need to eat. They still need to have attention. And most of them are doing it for outward effect. They're doing it so other people can look at them and see how they're doing. When we arrive at a spiritual level, we arrive at a spiritual level totally without the need to have anyone know about it, without the need to have anybody understand what we're doing. And we don't do it in a way that it embarrasses other people. For instance, you're on your spiritual path, and you're very serious about it, and your desire is to eat vegetarian foods. And people serve you foods, and they serve you meat on your plate, and they serve you all these things, and you're expected to eat it. And so you sit there, and you eat what you want to eat. And what you don't want to eat, you just leave it there. You don't say, I'm a vegetarian, and I don't want any meat on my plate. Well, that's a sick vegetarian. Because if you are whole and perfect, and you don't want any ill people around you, I don't want any ill people around you, get out of here, you're sick, you know. That doesn't work that way. You are a whole person. You see everybody whole and perfect around you. You don't see them sick. You are a vegetarian. You see everything on your plate, vegetarian. Some things appeal to you, some things don't. Now, I'm trying to think of some terrible thing. What would be a terrible vegetarian food that nobody really cares too much about? Something that's bitter, and it's just a normal vegetable type thing. Can you think of anything like that? Hard to think of some terrible vegetarian type of thing, or just any type of, well, let's say poison ivy. just from the point of view of what it is. And poison ivy, and they serve you some poison ivy on your plate. And it's vegetarian, you know. It's vegetable, you might say. And you know that it's not what you want. And you eat everything but that. And you just leave it. They, oh, that's so good. Haven't you tried that? You know. And thank you, but I've eaten all I care of it. Just to look at it was all I care to eat. You know. And that's your privilege. Now, do you have the permission to say no to something? Do you have the permission to say no if a person invites you to come into a room and the room is filled with smoke? And smoke is not your thing. I contend that firemen, if firemen were trained to go into smoky rooms and breathe the air that's within them, they would not be disturbed by the smoky room. Interesting? because I personally have gone into a number of fiery rooms to take pictures for my newspapers, and I'm taking the pictures right in the middle of the fire and smoke all around, and the firemen are dropping off around me, and I'm just taking pictures, and they say, get out of there, you don't have a gas mask on, you haven't got a smoke mask on, you haven't got this, get out of here, get a, oh, okay, you know, I hadn't even thought of it. I was so concentrating on taking my pictures and doing my job, and I hadn't even thought that the smoke was there. And this happens to us when we are really one-pointed on something. And if I was there and it didn't affect me, and the firemen were there and it did affect me, why didn't it affect me? It didn't affect me because my concentration was somewhere else. I mentally was breathing good air. I mentally was doing all the things. And really, when you are so one-pointed, when you are so intense on what you're doing, you don't breathe very much. You hold your breath, and you're not holding your breath because of the smoke. You're holding your breath because you're concentrating on getting a good picture and the angles and the things that you're doing. And then you take a breath, whoops, you get out of here, you know. But you're in there. You're breathing very shallow, but you're concentrating very intently, and you don't smell the smoke. Now, if the firemen could be trained to concentrate on what they're doing and breathe very shallow, they probably could go through that whole experience, be in there for an hour or so, and come out without being scathed by any of the smoke. They might have a little bit of sniffle in their nose of the smoke, but not enough. When we walk our spiritual path, we leave the body in its normal state, not needing us, not demanding things from us, not making itself known to us and making us feel like we have to give it attention, but just being free of it. So when we're free of it, then we can be concentrating on what we are. Okay, let's just say a spiritual man is whole and perfect. Okay? A spiritual being is whole and perfect. So you say, I'm whole and perfect, and your toe hurts. You say, I'm whole and perfect, and you know you have an illness. You know you have some problem somewhere. And you say, I'm whole and perfect, and your body says, ah, boy, are you blind. Don't you know you got this problem? Don't you know? And you just don't pay any attention to it. I'm whole and perfect. And then you say, I'm whole and perfect. And the doctor comes in and says, well, how are we feeling today? And you say, fine, doc. What do you mean, fine? You know, you should be in pain. You should have these things. And I'm whole and perfect, you say to yourself. You don't say it to the doctor because you don't want the doctor to think you're crazy. But just say it to yourself. And then the doctor comes in and he says, well, you should be dead by now. And so you get up and you walk out of the bed and you say, I feel fine, doctor. You should lay down. Hey, doctor, I feel fine. Take my pulse. You know, check my heart. I feel fine. But you shouldn't. Thank you, doctor, but I do. You see, when you are master of yourself, you have to be so clear about letting every other attitude, every other thought, whether it's the doctor, whether it's your neighbor, friend, mother, father, or the world, or even your own awareness of what you might have, let it go. Then you're walking your spiritual path. All things are your spiritual path. We've already said that. But let us think that our spiritual path is our highest and best. Let us think that our spiritual path is that which is the most beautiful thing we could ever want for ourselves. And when we think that it's the most beautiful thing we could ever want for ourselves, then we are having it. Then we are experiencing it. Then we are knowing it. And then it is ours. But it's not something that we can just wish for. It's something we have to put a cause in motion to really be very powerful about. Are you willing to do this, to do what it takes to do that? And that's what this seminar is all about. This seminar is all about In Us He Lives. The seminar is all about Mount Shasta. The seminar is all about being on our spiritual path, living from our divine center. Now, you want to go into Mount Shasta? Okay, we'll go in Mount Shasta. You want to go into yourself and be whole and perfect? Okay, well, go into yourself and be whole and perfect. You want to live as a master? Fine, we can live as a master. You want to live and be the master you are? Better, better, better. Then we will live and be the master that we are. However, if we live and be the master that we are, there is no room for us ever to say, I don't know. Even me. There's no room for anyone to say, I don't know. Give an answer, and it'll be correct. First off the top of your mind, give an answer, and it'll be correct. Live from your spiritual center. Live from your spiritual reality. Give that answer. Give that thought. Give that ideation from within yourself, and let it come out. And it is fantastic. But it is something we have to learn to do. Now, we'll go back to the dog or the child, and the mother says, sit, or stay here. Now, when the child does as the mother asks, the child is blessed, and the mother is blessed. When the child does not do as the mother asks, the child is not blessed, and the mother is not blessed. Because the child does not have the security that he needs to grow up to be an adult, and the mother does not have the ease of working with the child that she should have if she were a good mother. It takes time. It takes time to train a dog. It takes time to train a child. And a child is not trained by saying, don't. A child is trained by teaching it, this is good to do. This is good to do. These are good things to do. Have the child have so many good things to do, he doesn't even think of the things that he shouldn't be doing. He's really busy doing the things he should be doing. And this is true. This is true. Now, the same with the dog. If you say, don't to the dog, which is what we oftentimes do, the dog will learn don't, but the dog doesn't learn do. We say to the dog, sit, that's a do. We say, lie down, roll over, beg, do all these things. And then we say, jump over the hoop, and we say, stay by my side. And we think that this is manipulating the dog, and this is being cruel. Well, it's not being cruel. Let's go back to one point on that. Who created the dog? Why did we create the dog in our world? For our pleasure. We didn't create the dog in our world to be a pain in the neck, not to cooperate with us. We didn't create the dog for that. We created the dog in our world to be a loving, joyous activity for us. Something that was fun, something that we like having with us, something that we like having along with us, because it's a pleasure. Now, this is up to you, too. This is up to you, too. How long does it take you to learn the Pirelli horse training program? Level one.
Depends on my discipline.
Normally?
About 3 months.
Okay. Now, what do you do in training yourself and the horse in the first level of discipline?
I play with the horse.
You show the horse you love it.
Yes.
You play with it.
Yes.
And what else do you do?
After the friendly game, which is the playing.
After what?
After this friendly game, which is show that I love it,
yeah,
I show it to go in directions, to go all right from me and to me.
You give it training.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. First you get its attention,
yeah,
and share its love, and then you give it training.
Yeah.
Now, does it do immediately what you ask it to do?
If I do it right, yes.
It'll immediately walk away from you and come back.
No.
It can, though, can't it?
It can, yeah.
But it doesn't. It doesn't because you haven't trained yourself to believe it.
Depends on me.
Now, we saw this woman standing out here yesterday, and she held out her hand with a piece of bread on it. And this wild bird came and landed on her hand and ate the bread and then flew away. And then she had several of her little friends come out there and hold out their hands. Now, all of them were not successful, but some of them were successful. What attitude did they have in their mind?
The successful ones.
It works. Yeah, the successful ones. Yeah, the successful ones. The unsuccessful had in their mind, I hope, I wish. The successful ones had, like, enjoy success. The successful ones had in their mind, it works. Mm-hmm. You know? The same with walking on fire. The successful people have, it works. The unsuccessful ones have, it doesn't work. It takes a lot of training, you know, but it doesn't. Now, how quickly can you learn to have a bird come and sit on your hand?
Instantly.
When you have the idea that it works. It's not me the bird's coming for, it's the bread here, you know. And then after a while, it's me the bird's coming for. Other people can hold bread up there, but he doesn't go get it. But it's me. And when you start with the realization that it's you that the bird is coming for, then you are the master of yourself. Now, when you're training your dog or your horse, let's go back to your horse, and you tell your horse to go away, tell your horse to come back to you, how could you perhaps communicate that to a horse? How would you tell a horse to go away and come back? Would you say, go and come?
Well, to get it coming to you, you are humble.
Humble?
Yeah.
You act as though you would enjoy his presence.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And to get it going away, you have to stand up and show that you're power. Yeah, it's funny.
That same thing is what you do on your spiritual path. That same thing is what you do when your body acts up and you say, go, come. When your body says, I want this, I want that, I want this food, I want these clothings, I want this car, I want this house, I want these things. The same thing. Until you take charge of your own self, you won't get any of those things out there. You will get whatever thing you feel you're worthy of. Do you understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it you didn't marry the most wonderful man in the world? I haven't met him yet.
I did.
No. Huh? All right, with Ellen. We'll go to her. Why is it that you didn't marry the most wonderful man in the world?
I did.
Why did you marry the most wonderful man in the world?
Because I am the most wonderful woman in the world.
And you created him in your world.
Mm-hmm.
You taught him how to come and how to go, right? No, really. Was he willing to do that when you first were running around together? Did he go when you want something? Did you say, I'd like a drink? Did he go get it? You say, I'd like to have a sandwich. Just a minute, dear. You sit here, I'll get it. When you were in a restaurant or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Did he take charge in the restaurant? Did he always take charge in the restaurant? Who ordered the meals?
No, each one ordered his own meal.
He said, we're going to this restaurant.
Yeah, well.
And we're going to sit here. And we're going to do this. Now, here's the menu. Choose your menu.
Right.
I mean,
and then he orders it.
He ordered everything for everybody.
Right.
And then when you had made up your mind, you said, I want spaghetti.
Right.
And he said to the maitre d' or waiter, he said, and she'll have spaghetti. And she'll have a small glass of wine,
mm-hmm.
you know, or a tall glass of wine or whatever. And he knew what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So he went when you said to, and mm-hmm. he came back when you said to him.
Right.
Just like with the horse. It was trained because of your consciousness. You believed in yourself. Now, I know you don't think of Alias as a horse that goes and comes when you tell him to, but this is what anybody in our world is.
Mm-hmm.
It is trained. And Diego and Mariella, now, one was easy to train and one was a little more tough to train. And Mariella should have been the easy one to train, but she was tougher because she had a mind of her own. And Diego, he wanted to please you. And so he did virtually everything you asked him to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it very easily. And of course, you showered him with love. And Mariella, you wanted to shower with love, but she was on a different level and wasn't able to take it. So, you see, these are all things. Now, could Mariella have been as easily trained as Diego?
Yeah.
But you thought Mariella was independent. You thought Mariella wants to do her own thing. You thought Mariella is a real strutter, you know.
Mm.
And Diego stays close by my side. Well, Diego stayed close by your side once or twice, and so after that, Diego always stays close by my side. That was the image you had of him.
Mm-hmm.
And Mariella was out running around doing things, and you always had the image of her out running around doing things. Mm-hmm. See, we build up these images within ourselves on these things. And we build up these images about our body. We build up the images about our circumstances. And we live with them. Now, for instance, Little Love. When we called him King, he was a very aggressive dog.
Mm-hmm.
Because we thought of him as king of the dogs, king of the hounds. In the book it says he's the mini pincher, and he's a king, he rules everything. He'd like to do that. But with us now, we have him with Button, and Button does what he wants to do. And if Button wants to go running, and Love wants to chase with him, that's fine. And if Love has to stay behind, Button says, hey, come on, kid, we're going out for a run. And Love has to stay behind. But you see, we created Button as a very gentle, self-confident, capable young man to do anything he wanted to do, and yet take responsibility. We haven't trained him totally yet. And the same with the King, Love. Love, we've been working on him doing all sorts of beautiful things, but this is what we do with our consciousness. This is how we walk our spiritual path. This is how we become aware of our spiritual self. We have our physical body here as our vehicle for living on this plane of reference. How would you like to live on this plane of reference as just a consciousness? And go around as just a consciousness doing things and go around mentally seeing yourself skiing, mentally seeing yourself swimming, mentally seeing yourself eating, mentally seeing yourself doing all these things. Wouldn't that be thrilling? There'd be no sensitivity, no touch. There'd be no smell. You wouldn't smell the bakery. You wouldn't smell the horses. You wouldn't smell the warmth of their nose and so forth as you snuggle up with them. You wouldn't have any feeling of how it feels to have a full tummy because you're just a consciousness. And that's not all that much fun.
But don't we do that often? I thought we sometimes do that.
I'm not at that point. What we do is that we wouldn't really want that kind of an existence, because that kind of an existence is a higher level existence. It's an existence where you're not touched by the world, where you're unconditionally loving, where you're all these neat things. You see, when you do that, you are on such a level, and most of you do not want to lose your humanness, because humanness is fun. Sylvia loves to cook. And if nobody was eating and she wasn't eating, so what's to cook, you know? And Sylvia loves to typeset articles and gists and books and stuff like that. And if no one were to read these things, what's there to typeset the stuff for, you know? And this is what we do when we're on our higher level. Can you imagine a consciousness reading something to catch up on something? Can you imagine a consciousness eating anything? What's there to eat? Now, how does the consciousness exist?
It just
exists. It exists out of existence. It doesn't need any physical substance to exist. How does a physical body exist? Do you think that the food value you put in your body is what maintains your body?
No.
Not at all. It blows up your body and reduces your body and stuff like that occasionally, but it doesn't maintain it. What maintains your body are your thoughts. Your thoughts about yourself. You think you're sick, you're sick. You think you're well, you're well. You think you're happy, you're happy. You think you're full, you're full. And it's just the way it works. Now, we would like to be master of that area of our life. We'd like to be master of that aspect of our being, where we are in charge, where we are not manipulated by our body because it says I'm hungry. We have these people in Arizona who are eating nothing, and some that are drinking nothing, and scientific studies are being made of them. We have these people who live in the Himalayas that we read about who supposedly eat nothing. We look at the fakirs in India, fakirs I think they're called, but the fakirs in India, these are the people who sit on the street with one leg wrapped around here and one leg wrapped around here, and they sit like this always. They never change. They're welded. Their legs don't unbend. The muscles don't move anymore. They're one solid piece. Now, what are they proving? They're just proving that they can sit like that and someone else has to take care of them. Because they can't move their hands to feed themselves, they can't go to the toilet, they can't do anything. So, what's the benefit of that? Well, we don't know. And it's not something that we're pursuing to find out. But are they spiritual masters? No. They're just proving that they can walk on fire. Just one area of consciousness that they're being very active in, and they're proving that they can do it. Now, this is not really moving in your spiritual level, but it is showing that you can do it. You can do those things. You can do all those things and not need anything in the outer. But you must. You don't must do anything. If you want to have your spiritual consciousness develop in any direction at all, then you give attention to those things. You give attention to those things of not needing them anymore, being free of them, walking your wonderful path, and enjoying yourself. So, how many of you have ever gone without eating and not been hungry? Yes? How long?
Not long.
Well, you have to give me a figure. You have to give me a figure. If you don't give me a figure, I won't know.
Well, not eating, I considered also not eating when I was on the 30.
I'm sorry?
I consider not eating also when I was on the 30-day...
you went on a 30-day water fast. I mean, lemonade fast, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, that is certainly eating a minimum, isn't it? And so that would be fasting. That would be going without food, but not totally. And but how did you feel in going with a limited diet?
Oh, excellent.
If you felt so excellent, why didn't you stay with it?
Yeah, I know you said that.
You know I was going to say that to her. But no, if we felt so excellent, because we are conditioned to eat. Mm. We want to go back. We don't need that food, but we go back there and want to eat it. Now, what did Gregor tell us? Gregor, what did you tell us about being on the diet?
Well, after several weeks, I gained some weight again.
After several weeks, he did not lose weight anymore. He started to gain weight. That's interesting too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how much weight Greg would gain, and being such a slim fellow, I don't know that I would consider what he would consider gaining weight, but he might consider gaining about a couple ounces as gaining weight. But it is gaining weight. It's being more than you were before. But with him, he did just the opposite. Most people do. Most people feel they lose weight on such a diet.
Well, which I did too, but just after a while it stopped, mm-hmm. and then I gained a little bit, and then...
Mm-hmm.
But I was once on a water diet for 2 weeks too, and there may be, we're about 2 or 3 days where I was not hungry, where I was just really great.
Now,
but
what
otherwise I was more, the thought of a taste of the tongue was just so tough for me. You know?
Yeah. Now, when were you not hungry? At what? The first, second, third day, fifth day?
No, it was, it's a long time ago, but I think it was after about maybe fifth, sixth days or so.
Yeah.
A week or so. And towards the end, you know, it changed the thinking again. I knew I would go 14 days, and that's the point, you know.
Yeah.
but in the middle, I knew it still takes a long time, you know, kind of. But I was over the first few days, which were a little tough, and mm-hmm. then it was, you know.
Yeah.
But it is in the thinking. I always try to think, if I could just live in the now. Now I feel good, I'm satisfied, and keep that now moment and not change, not have time. Kind of just now the body's perfect and not...
All right.
You know.
Now, why didn't you keep that now moment?
No.
what is it that makes it so tough to keep that now moment? That's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, living in a kind of relative world, thinking in time and space and things, it's kind of tough not to live.
And having other people eating around you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is now. Let's just look at Greg for a moment. Could anyone of Greg's mentality actually do that? Live in the now moment? Do you think that he could really do that?
I think when some people that have a very interesting project, writers or artists, they do that often. Then they paint something that completely forget eating for several days. They're just so concentrated. And
mm-hmm.
their bodies are perfect. There's nothing...
Mm-hmm.
But that's the point. If I would be excited about something inside, which would be so fascinating, then I wouldn't be possessed by the body anymore, because it's just something else is there.
Yeah. Well, they say that a study has been done on people doing these things, and people fasting, and people thinking their thoughts, or, well, for instance, on scientists. Study's been done on scientists, and scientists can eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. They're big eaters, and they don't gain weight and they don't fill out, because the mental work that they do is I don't want to say devouring, but it uses up so many calories,
mm-hmm.
uses energy up so fast that they stay slim. So maybe we should all become scientists. but that's what they say about them, you know. In-depth scientists who really are into it and really working at, diligently at it, you know, to really figure it out.
Hmm.
So, but the point of all this is, how can we train ourselves so that we can be released of the need for things and just do it as we wish, eat if we want or not, but be released of the need of it, so that we can always be living at our highest perspective. And when we learn how to do that, then we really have achieved a great awareness in our life. Now, go ahead.
But I think if you see what I was thinking, if I could get excited about something like the spiritual path, my inner self, so much that This is for me actually the way to not be possessed by my body anymore. When I have something else,
sure.
It's just a spiritual thing, and it's so exciting. Then I forget actually my body in a way. And when I don't have that, you see, it's proven that people that are bored eat a lot, because they're bored. They just want to have an activity.
Sure.
And it is hard to just reduce them and not eat. And kind of force yourself not to eat if you don't have something else to go for. That's tough for me. It's more when I have something to go for, which is so exciting, so interesting, then I can easily reduce food and stuff.
When you're busy doing something you like to do,
exactly.
You don't have time to eat.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Then you don't think about it. You don't.
Ellen says that when Greg was driving the motorhome, she was feeding him and he was eating. But you see, that was not a fair test. If you weren't there to feed him,
I would have driven the same way.
He would have driven the same way. And,
oh,
and
I guess. I know.
And why is it that truck drivers usually are so heavy weight? Because they're sitting nibbling while they're driving all the time as something to do, because they're a little bored.
Yeah.
And if they drive the same route over and over again, then they get very bored.
Mm-hmm.
But the strange thing is that also during the juice diet, which and you do the same thing like always. I mean, it would be the same boring thing, that and there's nothing more exciting going on that that I had absolutely no desire for food. I was totally satisfied and I could watch people eating and it was not
sure.
Was not tough or anything.
Well, because it's a programming.
Yeah.
You know, well, for instance, like Greg said, he knew it was going to be 14 days. But you knew it was going to be 30 days. And that's a help, too. But actually, when you don't think of the days, live in the now, do it all in the present tense, then you can also lose that goal-oriented thing that it's going to be 14 days or 30 days or something like that, and you just do your thing,
mm-hmm.
And you're
the
comfortable.
Body stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
You live in the now. The body cannot change. It stays exactly the same. Always add on, you know?
Yeah, very beautiful.
That's the point.
Yeah, very beautiful.
But, yeah.
No, we have a excellent program set up for ourselves here if we would follow it. And the 3-hour meditation is a very beautiful thing, but it's sort of useless when we feel that we have to do it, or we feel that it's not comfortable doing it, we feel that we're doing it wrong. I have taught you what my version of the 3-hour meditation is. Now, that doesn't mean it's the only 3-hour meditation in the world or the only technique that there is. That's just one that I'm showing you. When you do your meditation, if you feel good within yourself, go for it. No matter what you do, you may stand on your head. You may lie in bed and go to sleep and just sleep and not want to wake up and say, I feel so good. I'm in my meditation. And then somebody comes along and uncovers the bed and there's some bones laying there. You were very comfortable just doing your thing. But that's okay. That's okay. Just be content with who you are. Be content with the game you're playing for yourself, because it is very wonderful. Yes, we have a good start here. A very good start. Well, we'll continue talking on this vein in the next talk and see what sort of things we can come up with on ways of even doing it better. Even doing the 3-hour meditation better, doing our spiritual illumining path better. Okay, bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you.